Hello. If you have been following us, we have this discussion every Wednesday about the upcoming sermons at our respective churches. I'm Scott Pence. I preach at the Mission Heights Church that is part of the Grand Prairie Church of Christ.
And I'm Alan Jones, and I preach here at Highland Park Church of Christ.
And I'm David Hockley at Coldstream Christian Church in Coldstream, British Columbia, talking about Mark chapter 2. 13 through 22.
I was trying to remember why we put these two together.
I think it was more or less because we thought we'd put the Sabbath ones together.
Yeah, I think so. But then I realized, I'm going to call this Let's Eat, because the first one is, why are you eating with sinners? And the next one is, why aren't you fasting?
Yeah,
so that was the... I couldn't remember. Why did we do this? We should just separate this out. But then there's that theme of let's eat. Eating and not eating and the social and eschatological implications of such activities. So,
well, it's interesting because what stood out for me, when I read through this is the theme, all things new means room for you, is kind of the phrase that came to my mind for a title. What's happening with Levi is there is the whole fasting, what's appropriate. I have some thoughts, about fasting and not fasting kind of thing, but just that whole, the whole that he's making, there's just something new going on now. And that changes everything, including how we relate to people and who fits and who doesn't fit kind of thing. But, any comments on last week, how you guys tied up last week's sermon or anything like that? What kind of, do we have room for talk about last week's sermon? Or did we just drop that? I'm sorry. You look stunned, Alan. I'm sorry.
I usually look stunned. That's a general state of being.
I had a bit of a discussion about forgiveness and healing and a potential relationship between those things. So
forgiveness and healing and the relationship with that. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the main conversational thing that I had afterwards. So,
yeah, I did the thing that carries over to this week ties them together. From last week, I talked a little bit about, standing on the truth while holding on to God's compassion, reaching out into lives that are broken.
Yeah.
Sinful and trying to bring those things together, which of course flows right through to Levi here. I mean, that's exactly what Jesus does, right? The interesting thing about that with Levi is about how I read one guy, I forget which guy it was, but he said, the big contrast between John the Baptist and Jesus is that, and most people, all kinds of people are ready to say to Levi, hey, you should stop sinning, you should quit doing this, whatever. The difference is that Jesus first calls to relationship and then confronts the sin. Like, he enters into relationship and then says, oh yeah, of course I'm in relationship with him. He needs a physician. And how easy it is for us to get it backwards, to think that we first need to point out sin and brokenness and all those things and confront it with the truth. And then, maybe then we can have a relationship. But Jesus flips that around, invites relationship, then confronts the sickness. So that's the connection for me from last week's text.
I think the one line of my own sermon that kind of stood up for me was I made the statement, your faith makes a difference and it's time to turn it loose. Like the four guys who had faith and they did something about it. They went to action. They cut a hole in somebody's roof.
Yeah.
And, and I think Jesus is like, if we look at the follow through, Jesus is, he's always kind of turning his faith loose. He's going places that he doesn't belong. He's saying things that shouldn't be said. He's, he's just, doing what's unconventional in many, many ways. And so what does it mean? What does it look like when we turn our faith loose? And, here he is, next thing, Jesus is acting on his faith, I guess, on his conviction of who he is, by, speaking to sinners and talking about. So it wasn't so much for me necessarily a direct connection with what's coming up here, but that's the thing from last week, is just thinking about that whole idea. It's faith makes a difference and that we need to turn it loose. Yeah, it was interesting. I realized as we have done our new style of preparation here with the recording for the podcast that we haven't done any how to go last week conversation as part of it.
Yeah, I guess we can put that in there again if we want.
I thought it was valuable because sometimes it was like, oh, because, you know, usually after we talk, we do some writing and some thinking and some things come out that we didn't even talk about, or they come out in ways we never expected.
Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a big thing for me was that phrase. I really kind of used, you completely stole your line about radical acceptance and transforming truth.
I think it's a big lesson for me anyway.
I just wrote the word opposite. I don't know why I wrote that down, but opposite of John the Baptist. Yeah.
So any controversial things in this week's passage? I mean, I think that there's not much. Well, I guess there's a bit of a controversy over whether Levi was Matthew. But other than that, it seemed like textually and overall, there isn't any big controversies on this one, eh? Seemed all like everyone was sort of going in the same direction from what I could tell.
For the most part, there's a little bit of what all is implied by the old wine and new wine skins and that sort of thing. But that's seems like the biggest thing.
I guess the other thing is the affirming sinners versus like how much of what he's saying that, you know, it's the healthy need a doctor, but it's not the healthy need a doctor, but the sick. It, you know, how much is he tongue in cheek saying, and you guys are sick, you just don't know it. And how much is he just saying, these people are sick and they need me. You know, how much of what he's saying is addressed, you know, tongue in cheek to the scribes and, or versus just actually, he's just describing the scenario of the people he's dining with.
Yeah. I mean, it might be one of those seeds that gets planted that in my mind, I don't think he would have expected them to put themselves there at that point. But later on, I mean, in Matthew, I think it's Matthew where you have the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, and which one goes away righteous sort of thing. So it might have been a seed planted for later on for it to be kind of fleshed out.
So are you going to unpack the question, who are the sick?
No.
Yeah, I think everyone will assume that it's everybody. I mean, that's what, whether or not, I mean, Jesus would certainly mean that, whether or not the scribes and the Pharisees would self-identify there. I doubt, because they were righteous in their own eyes. That was the whole deal, right? So they wouldn't even enter into people of the land's houses in case they hadn't tithed the food properly or washed properly, all that stuff. So
I thought it was, yeah, because I was reading a sermon this morning, and the fellow was talking about, can't remember whose sermon it was, but he used the example of standing in line at Starbucks. And there's this person who, you know, orders the same thing as you do. You kind of see them every morning, but they're like, it's this gal who's got tattoos all over and she's kind of like got goth look going on. And every time she has her trying to get her coffee out, she's trying to, you know, struggling with her backpack to get everything out. And says, you know, do you offer to hold their backpack? You know, do you just kind of say, can I help you or anything like that? Two things are like, by using the stereotype of the person that makes us uncomfortable, are we reiterating that the stereotype that the people who don't look like us are the sick people? You know, I remember even at the college when students would go out on their fall ministry experience, the first year students, I think in the old days, I don't know what happens now, but back in the early 2000s, they typically went down and worked at the mustard seed for a week. For their first year experience. And it was always amazing how many of them were just, you know, surprised and confused by the fact that how many of the people who live on the streets actually were followers of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Like they believed in Jesus, they had faith in Jesus. They maybe didn't have good management of their life, but, you know, in terms of, you know, you know, alcohol and issues like that, or just, you know, functioning. But they were always surprised at how many of them actually had a pretty significant faith. And so, you know, so in that sense, they weren't necessarily the sick as the sick and lost kind of thing, as opposed to dysfunctional in the world and maybe not sick spiritually at all. So anyway, I just had that kind of reaction a little bit. In that same sermon, he makes a great statement that I think is if you're debating the question, should I move into their world? We should pretty much always look at the answer is yes.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. You know, when I was looking back at some of the times I've looked at this passage before, some of my notes that Yancey's book, I think it's What's So Amazing About Grace, is that the title of it?
Yeah.
You know, it has those two stories. One is this, this single mom who's having real, real trouble and can't find help anywhere. And so he asked her, why didn't you come to the church? And he said, the church, that's the last place I'd go to. Why are you just going to judge me? And then his friend, who came out to him as gay, and then Yancey went with him to the gay pride parade. That book is written in like 97 or something, so it's not like, then it was a lot more controversial and more about, anyway, that whole deal of his thing was to go to stay in relationship with his buddy, even though he didn't agree with what the parade was saying, which is still the challenge, right? I think we're always afraid of, will my participation in this person's life give the message that we approve of the choices, the spiritual, moral, ethical choices that are being made? And where is that line? And how do you stay engaged but not cross the line, you know?
What's that verse that talks about bad company corrupts
good character?
Yeah. Good character. I think that's one of the Proverbs, right?
Maybe it's in Titus too, isn't it? But Proverbs. Anyway, yeah. So and yet, I think we mostly, myself anyhow, are more on the other side. I think, you know. Well. Not into that, so.
More on which side?
Not having anything to do, like just staying far away. Mm. Like I can't imagine going to a gay pride parade.
1 Corinthians 15:33, the bad company corrupts good.
15:33. 1 Corinthians 15:33. Interesting, and that I wouldn't have put that in my mind with 1 Corinthians 15.
I know, hey?
When you think about what 1 Corinthians 15 seems to be all about, is the new body and that transformation.
I just thinking about what it meant to recline at a table. Have you seen kind of visuals of what they think that looked like? You're pretty close quarters with people and laying down, like with the, like leaning on one side and the other guy's nearly laying right up against you, sort of thing. I mean, when in John, when it talks about him leaning back on his breast, I mean, it's literal, right? They're laying right there next to each other. And so if Jesus is reclining at the table with these fellas, like it's pretty close.
Very un-British.
Exactly. It's not meeting across the table for coffee. Yeah. It's up close and personal. There was something about that, even just the physicality of reclining at a table with folks like this that are going to be seen in particular categories. I don't know, even the physicality and visual of that is kind of adds an extra layer for me.
Well, I know it, my mind, I can't get around. I just keep going back to, how does that even practically work? Is where my mind goes. How do you actually eat a meal? Like, how do you get, you know, like that kind of thing just seems so awkward and like,
prop up on one elbow.
Prop up on one elbow and eating is like, you know, I'm thinking my age, by the end of it, my shoulder would be sore, my neck would be sore. It's like.
Might help me deal with my sin of gluttony if we had to.
You don't need to eat as much, I guess. Yeah. So that's just, it's funny. My mind just gets overwhelmed with the logistics of how does that actually functionally work for eating a meal, you know, kind of thing. So,
The visuals that I've seen, it feels like there's almost a little rise up there. So you could, it's almost like you could lay on your chest or whatever and go with
slide it in
with two hands because the table's a little bit down below, at least what I've seen. Yeah. You typically would lean up on the left and eat with the right. So,
well, I know when we were in Haiti, we were watching a bunch of ladies, they prepared food for like 500 kids. And they didn't have any countertops. They just cooked. They sat kind of cross-legged or on some small stool, and they were cutting onions and peppers and putting chicken and putting them in big pots that were just sitting on, like on wood fire on the ground, and they cooked food for like 500 people.
Wow,
it was like
labor intensive and hard on the body.
Oh yeah, that's true. It's like when I suggested that when they're talking about renovating the kitchen, that the women should consider how the women in Haiti prepare food. They suggested I consider living in Haiti. Well, you want to move to Haiti? That'd be good. So, anyway, I think it's interesting that whole idea of closeness to people too, eh?
Yeah, certainly not COVID friendly.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So, question on the fasting. Jesus talks about the time will come. He says, how can the guest of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? They cannot do so as long as they have him with them. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and on that day they will fast. On the when you like, it just has some issues that I think through this. What's his name? The commentary that we have. Can't forget his name.
Lane.
Yeah. He goes into this whole idea that the joy of Christ's presence, because there's almost like an attachment with fasting and mourning.
Yeah.
You know, because legitimately the Jews really only fasted one day a year at the Day of Atonement. And that was definitely a fasting of mourning. And in some ways, you know, John the Baptist's fasting would have been, no doubt, an element of mourning the sin and the condition of the world, and the Pharisees saw it maybe slightly different as a witness of their holiness, I guess, more that they fasted 2 days a week. But you know, so in that sense, how does that fit with fasting today, or is that even something worth worrying about here in that sense? Because you know, of course, the last verse of Matthew is, and lo, I will be with you always. And a lot of the Christian life is telling people, Jesus is with you. Jesus is with you. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to kind of celebrate the joy of his presence. So we're celebrating the joy of his presence and he's with us. Where does fasting come in for believers in that sense?
Well, to me, this whole deal is a discernment before God as to what is an appropriate response for the occasion that you find yourself in. Because sometimes, if folks are prone to kind of legalistic sort of inclinations, right? There's reasons for the rules that they follow. But sometimes it misses the situation that you're in, the situation right in front of you, so to speak. I don't know, to me, it reminds me of some of the Proverbs that, you know, on the one hand, I'll say, don't answer a fool according to his folly, and then follow it up by saying, answer a fool according to his according to his folly. And very often will tell you to keep your mouth shut, but then sometimes tells you to speak up. And so what Jesus seems to be appealing to here is a recognition of the time, like read the time that you're in, and then out of your faith and knowledge of God, respond to it. I don't know. There are times when it's good to bear witness that a behavior or a way of life is not something that we endorse and so on and so forth. And so there'd be a time to kind of as a statement of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, judgment, to say that's not what I'm about. But there might be a time to, like you were talking about with Yancey, to go ahead and enter in, because what the door of opportunity the Lord's opened up for me kind of calls for that response at this time. And so makes it less kind of rule-based and more, you know, follow the Spirit and discern what God's opened up before me. I don't know. That's what it all made me think about for some of those Proverbs.
The, technically speaking, the Jews were required to fast the Day of Atonement, but there were other times they did fast. You know, the prophets called them to declare a fast, you know, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think in the book of Esther, when they were threatened with their life, did not they call the Jewish people to fast?
Yeah, and then Purim came out of that. So I think, yeah. I think for the regular Jews by the time of Jesus, I think they had 5 regular fasts by then, I think.
Okay.
And then, of course, the Pharisees did their twice a week deal, but I think they added 4 fasts to the Day of Atonement. Can't remember what they all are. Purim was one of them.
I almost think in our world today, like talking about fasts might kind of miss the point of the conversation of fasts here.
That seems to me as well. I just might fill in a little bit of background. Like you said, there were 5 fasts that they regularly participated in, blah, blah, blah. But it's, to me, this text isn't really about fasting.
I suppose it depends if you, I mean, it depends how closely you tie that fasting to, you know, the eschatology of the passage, right? Because John's, you know, because there's a certain sense of fasting to bring the Messiah on board so the new eschaton can begin. And so, you know, that's sort of like the whole, like Hockley's main thing there, all things are new, means there's room for you. I mean, it's because of the arrival of the eschaton, right? And that's the whole, whether it's fasting or the wineskins or the cloth, it all has to do with the eschaton, and it's arrived. And the practice of the eschaton arriving is a new way to deal with sinners like me and Levi. So I think that to me would be the mention of the fasting would be how it ties to the hope of the eschaton. Mm-hmm. Lots of silence in this conversation. Is it we didn't do it at the end of time, or what's the deal? Or it's obvious, is there nothing to talk about?
Well, I think just I'm kind of reflecting on that whole, like, how do we fit that in, you know, the preachability of it, you know, in terms of what's the exegetical side of this and how pertinent is it? Like, is fasting the issue? But no, I don't think fasting per se is the issue. Is this passage about teaching people today how to fast? I don't think so.
It's about how to get good wine. That's the point of the passage.
how did I ruin your wine? You have to spill out on the ground, you know? So that could catch on in BC here. It's like, what? So I think the, because I was thinking about that tying it in with the new age of, you know, in terms of what does this new world look like? And I think it ties in with how we relate to people for sure. And I think Watts makes a good point about talking about, you know, about when people go, like, there's a lot of emphasis on here that how we should accept people who are sick. See, but, you know, people don't go to the doctor to stay sick. Like, the fact that you're going to the doctor presumes there will be a transformation in your life. So when people say, well, we should, you know, accept the LGBTQ plus agenda, you know, testimony of where they are in their life and say, that's all okay. We should just love them. We should accept them, because Jesus here shows how he's accepting them. And Watt says, well, no, that's the point. The doctor goes to the sick person, not to leave them sick, but to make them well. Now, but he does see them. That's the whole point. You know, he sees them from where they are, and he doesn't close his, well, now they close their doors to the sick people, but historically, doctors always put themselves in the proximity of people who were sick. And like I say, other than this whole COVID thing, that's now it's now their proximity is by a phone, right? But or I guess if it's a real thing where they actually have to see you, they will make arrangements to see you, right? But
yeah. You know, just when you were saying something there, you said Hockley, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it triggered in my mind the question of what about the new age bursts open my wineskins? You know, I have my preconceived ideas about how things should be too. But what is it? What is it that Jesus comes and brings that blows, you know, boom. Oh, it's not my idea.
That really burst my wineskins.
Yeah.
And Brad is saying that nobody would understand.
it's a test for the truly biblical interest. If you get this saying, you know your Bible.
Yeah. There's a that it really bursts my wineskin. I think in that other side sense is that. Whatever is new is expanding. So in what way?
Except for the cloth one where the new cloth shrinks.
What's that?
Except for the next one is the cloth that shrinks. The new cloth shrinks.
How about it's moving?
Okay, it's moving. You can say that. I don't know if it's coming or going, but it's moving.
That's my whole life. I don't know whether I'm coming or going, but I'm going to keep moving. Yeah, so I guess that I know my wife always says my feet are stuck in cement. So don't like change, but I guess is he saying to us by this, is this part of the message to say what ways are you locked up in what's old and past? Like at the time of Christ, he's really talking about the limits, to a certain extent, the limits of the old covenant, right?
Certainly of the practices that had been implemented as in their understanding of the old covenant.
So did anybody pull out Ron Snyder's old book from the 70s, New Wineskins?
No, I thought about it. But I mean, I thought about the title of the book, but I didn't pull it out.
Be interesting how he applied that passage, because that was very much based on a critique of the church.
Yeah.
But I wonder how many of those critiques are valid and how many fit the actual exegesis of the text versus the analogy of the text, right?
I've not read that book, so I don't know.
You're too young. When was the last time I heard anybody say that, Scott?
You know, more often than you would think.
And it's your own Jones all the time, right?
I think I'm kind of immature, so I kind of present younger.
Yeah.
But I was born in the 70s. So.
Yeah. Well, this book came out probably about 73 or something like that, 70, maybe 75.
Yeah. I was a preschooler.
Yeah. It would be interesting to kind of, I think I might go see, I don't think I have it in my own library. I think the church has it in the church library, though. I might kind of peruse that and just see what's in there, if there's anything that kind of stirs a thought about the how as churches we become bound up in tradition. It's like they say that they talk about the contemporary worship, in many ways contemporary worship is the new traditional worship, right?
Yep.
There's some very solid forms in terms of what has to happen in the order of things. And
I remember a young woman back in the first decade of the 2000s here talking about how the songs that really spoke to her were the choruses that were written in the 90s. And so that for her, that had become the new hymnal. and she didn't like these new choruses that were coming out from whoever at the time nearly as much as the stuff that she whatever learned in college in the 90s. So.
Yeah,
you get stuck in our formative and enjoyable years, right? I mean, I remember reading an article about how people, whether it's their clothing style, the music they listen to, we tend to stick with when is our most enjoyable time of life and when we felt most successful. And we stick there. Most people. I'm usually 20 years behind that. So
yeah, look at your playlist. Who's on your playlist, I guess, on your phone, if you have one, you know. And if you don't have a playlist on your phone, that says something too.
Exactly.
So like I found this playlist on YouTube Music, and it's called The Father Daughter Road Trip.
Okay.
And it's like, it's great songs. It's like all the songs. It's like, if you know, you got everything from some Johnny Cash to Creedence Clearwater Revival, the Beatles, it's got all these, and it's like, oh, that's a good range of songs kind of thing, you know, for, you know, driving across the country with your daughter or whatever kind of thing. So, but I just thought about that, how that so much of those, not all of the songs, but they're all within proximity of kind of my, the high school or college years kind of thing, you know?
Yep.
But I think that's,
yeah, cause I'm 10 years younger than you guys. And to me, that's like old music.
Yeah.
But my music is really old compared to my kids. So.
Yeah. The glory years, right? Springsteen's talked about.
I was having a discussion. So we have a fellow in our church that is at Mission Heights, the most regular worship leader.
Yeah.
Who also works at one of the local bars. He runs sound for the bar, has for years, and occasionally he'll perform there. He has a band and this kind of thing. And it's interesting, for the most part, I think at least the people at Mission Heights, we don't think anything of it, but occasionally somebody will be shocked that he, as a Christian, works in that kind of environment, sort of thing. And because they were taught a certain way and taught the scriptures and what Christians should and shouldn't do in a particular way. But it's interesting. He periodically will have somebody that either works there or that he's connected to there that shows up at church for a while. And alcohol really and legitimately is just, it's not a temptation for him at all, but he does see it as an avenue of ministry. And he's in environments and has contact with people that I likely never would. And so but from certain standpoints, it's good Christians don't hang out there. But for him, that's the wrong patch on the wrong piece of cloth.
So when you think about your focus of this, what do you gravitate towards to in the preaching side of things?
For me, I think it's the whole thing of Christ entering in relationship prior to dealing with the sin. You're still dealing with the sin, and that is the way of the new age.
Yeah, careful using the words new age.
Not anymore. Reclaim it.
Yeah, it's gone now, man.
New era. The new era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose for a few people, it's still a bit of a trigger word or whatever, but I think it's 20 years ago.
Or the new eschaton. There we go.
And for me, the deal that we talked about last week fits better in this text. The reaching as far as you can go while standing firmly on the truth. That's, to me, that's what I will probably will largely guide what I'm doing this week. So I didn't, that's not the angle I took last week. So
yeah, I'll probably jump from that as a reminder. But
yep.
It is, to me, this whole thing of how do we relate, you know, that reaching in as far as we can with compassion, like how do you do that and still stay on the truth, you know? Because it very much is like, you know, the understanding of eating together is saying that there's no relational problem here. You know, it's deep fellowship. And so that's why the Pharisees are so horrified. So does that still mean that, you know? So if I have a close friend who is in exactly the opposite direction, I remember Brazikian, Bill Hybels' mentor there.
Yeah.
He said one time, you know, who talks to the beer-swilling, wife-beating, unemployed ignoramus that lives on the corner of your block? Christians should.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all have our categories that we find abhorrent, and yet we're called to be in relationship and not agree with those choices. So how does that work, and how is it that we've gotten one way or the other? We either have nothing to do with, or we believe, yo, unless I totally affirm this and say it's okay, then I'm not loving this person. It just drives me bonkers.
Well, and you know, that's become the mantra of our world, that to love someone means to accept them, right? It means to accept them. If you don't accept them, then if you don't accept and
affirm
their lifestyle, you haven't loved them. And in fact, I think they would even take it further, that they would say it's to do violence against them. You know, you think of how the people operate in universities, where you can't, you know, there's, if you speak of the non-approved channel, they won't let you on campus, you know, because people see that as violence against them.
Yeah. I think the distinction between accepting and affirming is an important one,
but I don't know that right now. Like, I think it's an important one to make, but I think there's a good part of the world that's just not going to buy that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's why we're in trouble.
Decided to not affirm
the whole thing.
And to not affirm is actually to do violence against them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I don't think that's right, but I think that's the world we live in right now.
So. Yeah. So how do we function? Like, given this text, how do you function within that world? Like, that to me is the, because I think that we as the church, generally speaking, big generality, it's like we're swinging towards the no, accept means affirm. Like, I just think.
I think we just keep saying it. You know, I think maybe that's all we can do is keep saying it, is they're welcome in my house, but that doesn't mean I'm going to say
what you're doing is right. No.
I'm not going to say what you're doing is right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the big challenge for us as Christians. It's tough.
But it's a potential, you know, it's a potential witness in an age when more and more people, or it's more and more common to see people encourage others to cut folks out of their lives if they have opposing views on things.
Yeah, cancel culture, right?
Yeah.
That's a big thing.
And so to have, for the church to have a witness that we can eat with somebody and accept even while clearly not affirming, but love this person, that these things, one does not have to mean the other.
Yeah.
Yep. And I guess really, you know, the more you think about it, the more it's exactly the same, because that was the Pharisees' position, right? Like, obviously you affirm this guy. Obviously you don't want the Messiah to come. Obviously you're happy with Rome ruling us.
Obviously you're happy with what, did you say?
With Rome ruling us.
Pharisees were happy with that?
No, they're saying that to Jesus, because he's eating with, you know, the minions to Rome, the tax collectors, you know. So you're supporting the very structure which allows Rome to rule over us, let alone prevent the Messiah from coming. Jesus had to confront that. No, that's not what I'm doing.
Yeah.
It looks like that, but it's not what I'm doing. Be interesting, like with, you know, I don't think do any of the synoptics address Jesus actually saying to Levi, you know, this gouging on the tax floor here, man. That's got it. Like, none of them do, right? He kind of comes, like in Matthew there, he comes it to himself, right? Everyone I've done, I'll pay back double. And
isn't that Zacchaeus that does that?
Oh, that's Zacchaeus, the tax collector, though, yeah.
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 Yeah, Levi keeps his money. As far as we know, we don't know what Levi did with his money, his extorted funds, you know. So, but yeah, I bet you for most times we could throw in the Zacchaeus parallel and not mention that it's actually a different guy, and it probably fly for about 95% of the people, but probably not good exegesis though. So
I wonder though, that's interesting. I wonder why, you know, like in other things, Jesus, you know, go and sin no more, or. But with these guys,
well, he got up and followed. He did the same thing as the fisherman. He got up and followed. He left his business and went up and got up and followed. Right. So it's the exact same thing as Peter, Andrew, James, and John, just different business.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the assumption is when you follow somebody, because that's what the disciples did. They then begin to model their lives.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which we maybe don't see a lot of Jesus saying specifically to them, but we see them. Those same disciples saying the same thing later when they write their gospels and they write stories about people, Jesus saying that. So we can assume if they're writing it about other people having changed their lives, that was part of their journey too, right? You know, Paul saying.
In some ways, Levi's doing that was more radical than the other guys, because the other boys could go back to dad's business. Once you gave up this tax gig, you had to bid on that sucker and pay money for it and stuff. It was not an easy thing to get. So Levi essentially wouldn't be able to go back. The other guys could always go back. A lot of the commentators point out that Levi couldn't go back.
A lot of obstacles to that. Yeah. Yep.
It's interesting. We had a guy in our church. He's in a treatment center now for a teen challenge. And he was like, you know, part of our church, but he was actually selling.
This guy last week.
Yeah. And I was thinking about it. Even when we were kind of, you know, getting ready, helping get set up to take him to Teen Challenge, one of his biggest concerns was all the money that was still on the table from the guys that owed him money for drugs.
Yeah.
And everybody saying, guys, just leave it, forget it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was like, it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, and he's thinking about the difference that'd make for his family, you know, just but to walk away and leave that on the table is.
Yeah.
He was still trying to collect as he's trying to get off the treatment center. The irony is there for us, but still, like when you think it's a good gig and you maybe you wasn't earned legally, but you still worked for it, kind of thing. So
it had been there'd been some shock value, I guess, that Jesus would choose this guy to follow to be a disciple of his. This is who this is who you that this rabbi kind of gathers around him, and as Levi, Matthew continued to follow around, I mean, certainly up in Galilee, people would have known who he was.
Yeah.
They would have definitely had a certain category for him, and Jesus seemed okay with that kind of company.
Well, it's kind of a double shock, right? Because rabbis didn't recruit disciples. Disciples came to rabbis. So first shock is a rabbi that recruits. Second shock is, This is
who?
Yeah, it's a double whammy though.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You think about that, and like say, like he would have been well known in Capernaum area, and maybe in quite a bit broader area, you know, because people had to go somewhere to pay their taxes, and he was happily smiling, taking it and gouging them. Yeah, it is interesting. That's another interesting perspective that he not only dined with them, he added this guy to the roster.
Yeah.
And people are saying like, whoa, I've got to question your leadership here, because that's seems like a very questionable choice. It kind of goes back to that story about, I can't remember who told it. I heard it back maybe when I was in college. There's two elders are talking about from different churches at a church conference. And the one, they're just hiring this young guy. And the other guy is like, he notices that the other elders look at him kind of funny. And he says like, oh, I said, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that this guy is not going to make it, that he doesn't have what it takes and he's going to fail. And he said, well, I'm just here to tell you, he's not going to fail because we're not going to let him fail. Mm. You know, we're going to walk behind him. We're going to help him succeed. And I thought it was an interesting how often that could be all of our stories, you know, like, is Jesus pick people who are certain to fail and makes them succeed? And that might be.
You could also say that he saw Matthew as a guy here's a guy that succeeded. We just need to change the direction of his success.
That's another way to look at it too. Yeah. Yeah. this guy's got some potential. Well, that would be certainly when you talk about Stanley, Andy Stanley's thing. He quite often pursues people who are successful in business to lead in ministry.
All those guys did. Highball, all those guys, eh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we've got 5 minutes. Any last thoughts?
I'm just trying to figure out whether this whole theme about how to work in that the joy of Jesus' presence, if that needs a strong place in that.
Yeah, well, that's part of this
not fasting
reason that he selects wine as the first parable, right? It's because the drinking of wine, and the wine is the joy of the new eschaton, the joy of the Messiah coming, the joy of the promised land. All that imagery of wine in Israel, the Old Testament, is celebration of the coming of the king and the victory of the kingdom. Place of bounty, symbol of bounty, goodness.
And that's a good question, I guess, is when people in our church, do they experience the new eschaton in our church as celebration to joy and the bounty of living life with Jesus? Does that typical people's typical experience of the church?
The mix,
yeah. And I guess if it's not, what's the action? And some of it may be the action of, you know, the people aren't experiencing the joy because they don't have changed hearts to match the nature of the joy, which would be the joy of, you know, reclining at the table with sinners, you know?
Yeah, the presence of Jesus.
That's my query going into this. I don't have the answer. I don't know how I'm going to preach that, but.
Well, I mean, that's in some ways that ties into Luke's lost parables, right? And prodigal son, if you're not embracing these new folks that are coming in and realizing that there's a place for those who have been sick to come and get healed and to join the party over that, then you are the older brother kind of left outside, missing out on the joy of this new era, this new age.
Might be an interesting question to talk to the doctors that we know and find out for them what is the biggest experience of joy in their practice and what is the biggest source of discouragement.
That might be on their personality and their age.
Yeah.
I think for my father-in-law, the biggest joy was correctly diagnosing the problem. Seriously, like he enjoyed that aspect of it, the diagnostic aspect of it. And his biggest pain was the politics.
I remember a friend of ours who works with Working Emerge, and all the Emerge doctors take a turn kind of being the lead guy, you know, which is about, you know, working with the nurses in the hospital and kind of managing that. And they all take turns doing that. They don't just have one guy who's in charge of that. We were talking about it. Another guy said something about, oh, that might provide kind of some interesting variety to your work. And he goes, oh, please, I would rather stick shards of glass in my eyes. So yeah, that whole the bureaucracy and things like that.
Yeah, I would say most of the medical people I know, it's the political tie-ins and things like that that are their, it's the biggest joy sucker for them.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Yeah, which fits the old and new wineskins, eh? That what kills us is the rules and the framework and the judgment, and, you know, those are the things that kill people in church, right? And when we're no longer looking to how we make people well, or when well people are just acting, living in their sickness and never getting well, no. Because they won't. Like if you tell somebody you need to walk and they refuse to walk, then I think that's frustrating for doctors, that people come back and they want a pill. They don't want to actually physically do what they need to get well too.
I told Alan this story. My brother-in-law, he was reflecting on legalism, and he said that in his church, they have tried as hard as they could to be a place of grace. And so he was absolutely mortified when his young teenager was among the most legalistic creatures he had ever encountered, his own kid. And he's like, where did he get this? Where did this come from? And what the conclusion he eventually came to is that this is a stage of development. There are most people go through a stage where they need things clearly defined, black and white, and so on. And you'll see that in certain kids. And then he posited whether legalism was a developmental delay that it's a stage that you haven't matured through. Mm. And so I just thought it was an interesting, at least thought experiment.
Yeah. And I guess that's an interesting comment in terms of why people like, yeah, kids go through a stage. I remember my son, when I grew up on the farm, we didn't have sidewalks to shovel off. So right. Like when we lived first years in ministry in Lethbridge, you know, shoveling the walk was not something that was high on my priority list. And Edith grew up in the city and you always shoveled your walk first thing in the morning. And so she had these like rigid rules about when you do things. And so anyway, we got a new shovel and I was out shoveling the sidewalk and Brett's at the window and he turns to Edith and says, "Mommy, why are you making daddy do your job?" Oh, I put Brett in detention after saying that for sure. Because you know what happened after that.
There's a myriad of assumptions that go into that little statement.
Oh, yeah. It's like, wow. That messed up my whole life from there on in. The other thing Brett said one time, he was taking out the compost to the compost bin outside. And he says... he comes back in and he says to Edith, "Oh, that stinks. When I get married, my wife's doing that job." So that was Brett's job from there to eternity. But yeah, that whole sense of here's some rules about how things are going to work kind of thing, you know.
Let me explode that wineskin right here and now.
Well, yeah, I guess it's a question of looking back and saying, where are some areas that I need to grow up in, you know? Because it's an interesting story.
All right, well, we should pack her in. We're a little past the hour, so.
Okay,
silence.
Yeah, we'll cut it down to 15 minutes when Chris gets done editing.
Did you want to pray? Or?
Sure. Father, we want to thank you for the new creation, for the new life. And we thank you that Jesus continually comes and he does bust our wineskins. He shows us new things about ourselves, about the world, about himself. And we pray, Lord, as we try to communicate some of these marvelous truths to the folks that participate in the sermon event, that you would just guide us, that Holy Spirit, we would zero in on the things that you have for these folks in a very particular way. So help us, God, to hear you well, to be faithful to the text, to be faithful to our people, and above all, to be faithful to you. So guide us, we pray, through Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.